This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Heather Williams says she never experienced racism until she was 11 years old. That's when she moved to Brooklyn from Jamaica and became a minority for the first time in her life. In high school, she began to learn America's racial history. She would spend her free periods on the floor in the library devouring books from the Black Studies section. She identified with the people she read about and their struggles for equal rights. Her fascination with this history would lead her to become a civil rights lawyer and later a teacher of history. Today, she's an associate professor in the history department at UNC Chapel Hill. She focuses her research on African Americans during the 18th and 19th century. Her book is called African American Education in Slavery and Freedom, Self-Taught is the name of the book, and we will meet Heather Williams today as part of our North Carolina Voices series to commemorate the 150th anniversary of the start of the Civil War. Heather Williams, welcome to State of Things. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Many African Americans grow up with some understanding of racism. You grew up in Jamaica, a country that's majority black, then came to New York when you were 11. How did things change for you when you moved to Brooklyn?
Well, it changed in lots of ways, lots of personal ways, so that my mother had left us in Jamaica for a year and a half to come to America to make a place for us to work and to rent an apartment, that kind of thing. We stayed with my father. And so coming to America was kind of, it was bittersweet for me because I did not want to leave Jamaica. I loved the place. I had friends. It was just great. But I wanted to be with my mother. And so it changed dramatically in that way that we were all together again. But in a bigger way, it changed because for the first time, I found out that I was supposed to be inferior to white people. And before I got here, I really had very limited consciousness of white people. I'd seen a few people driving in their cars, going, I don't know where, tourists. And we would talk about, you know, the fact that they looked kind of funny. We thought their noses were very straight. But they just were not significant in my life. In Jamaica, over 90% of the population is black. And then we had some Chinese people and some Indian people and then some mixtures of Chinese and Indian and black and some white, but just not many. And so I got here and I found out in seventh grade that I was supposed to be inferior to white people. And I found this out through the white boys in my class. I was in the special progress class, which is the sort of gifted class. And so we're all supposed to be smart, but the white boys definitely thought they were smarter than everybody else, including the white girls, but definitely smarter than my friend Nydia, who was Puerto Rican and smarter than me. And so we would compete. I competed with them. We made bets about who would do better on which, on the French test or the science test. And we would bet money because that was kind of my way of thinking about it. But I remember going home upset sometimes. And my mother's response always was, oh, they're just jealous of you. She calls me Andrea. That's my middle name. And she would say, oh, Andrea, they're just jealous of you. And I don't know where she came up with that, but that was her response. And it kind of, it made it something small. But I also saw it in the neighborhood as the white, we moved onto a block in Brooklyn in East New York that was all white, mostly Italian. And over the next couple of years, really, literally 2 to 3 years, the younger white people just all moved out. All the families with children left. And the block became more and more black and Puerto Rican. And so that said something to me. You know, it was, I had a name for it later on, which is white flight, but I didn't have that name then. I just noticed that things were different. We were never invited to their homes, even though their children came and played with us and drank our soda, which my mother always told us, don't let them drink up all your stuff.
Well, you know, I want to think about those seventh grade boys, though, for a minute. Were they open about the reasons they thought they were better than you? Did they tell you specifically it's because they were white, you were black? You couldn't be that
no,
smart?
I mean, it wasn't that blatant, but it was strongly implied. I mean, I certainly didn't go there with any consciousness of this being a possibility. So I picked it up from them. And from a couple of our teachers as well, who just, most of them were fine. Most of them were encouraging. I did really well in middle school. But there was this sense that you were different and that you were not as good as. And it was just something that I took really as a challenge. I mean, it upset me on one level, but then I just took it as a challenge because nobody had told me this before. I didn't know this. And it just didn't make any sense to me. So.
And of course, it's at a difficult time. I mean, you're an 11-year-old girl. This is just about the time when we're trying to create a new identity for ourselves. So, you're kind of shedding the old shell. And
right.
It's a very vulnerable time for anybody to be confronted with that kind of question.
Yeah. So, but, you know, I wasn't going to let it stop me. My mother wasn't going to let it either. My mother went up and fought her battles at school with teachers who she thought were trying to track me in certain directions. And she thought that was because I was Black. And so she had to fight those battles. And so you kind of get a sense, you know, I think it's like African-American kids growing up in America. You know,
right.
it may happen at a different stage, but there are these feelings that you get. And I think that in some periods it's spoken, it's said, and other times it's more subtle, but you get the message.
You talked about the tracking. Now, you were in a kind of gifted and talented program initially. As you looked around you, did you notice evidence of tracking that suggested racism?
Absolutely. I went to school for 7th and 8th grade in a neighborhood in Brooklyn, sort of on the border with Queens, that was totally white. And this school had just recently been integrated. And so in the gifted class of, let's say, 30 to 35 students, there would be, I think, maybe five of us who were Black and Puerto Rican. And then everybody else was white. And then as you went down, so they had in seventh grade maybe seven or eight different classes. And as you went down, and it was clearly down, you knew it was down, you got more and more Black kids. So in the second and third tier, you'd still have predominantly white. As you got farther down, more Black, more Puerto Rican. And when you got to the very bottom, lots of Puerto Ricans. And I think that was a language issue that they were being tracked as dumb because they didn't speak the language. And so, yeah, it was very clear. And the Black kids were bused in. We took the city bus to school because we lived close enough. Other kids were brought in from, I don't know even where they came from, just farther than we did. So it was very clear that there was tracking and there was this kind of resegregation within the school because you really only had contact with the people in your class.
There's a couple ways you can interpret that, I would think, a couple ways at least. One is to just internalize it and to say, you know, to begin to see this as the pattern and say that must be the way it is because you're not saying it, you don't articulate it. And the other is to become conscious and say, I wonder what's going on here.
Yeah.
What was happening to you at that age? You're pretty young.
Yeah, I was pretty young, but I think I was conscious of it, and partly because I have younger siblings, and so I could see how they were treated differently than me. I could see how my brother was treated differently, because, you know, being a Black boy is that's tough. And so, yeah, I was conscious of it. I was conscious of some friction between some of the Black girls in the I don't know what tier they were in, fifth or sixth or seventh tier, I don't know. And those of us who were in the higher tier, because now you're with these white people. And so, there's definitely a level of consciousness. Of course, you know, over the years I've come to reinterpret and to add what I know now. But I was definitely aware of it and concerned about it.
Well, when did you become interested in African-American history?
I think really in high school. I don't remember reading much about African-American history when I was in junior high. I was pretty much doing what I was doing in school. And when I went to a high school in Brooklyn called St. Anne's, which is not Catholic, it's a very unorthodox school. They don't give grades. We had free periods even in ninth grade. And so I spent a lot of time during my free periods in the library. And at that point, Annie Bosworth was a librarian, and she had a section called Black Studies. Later on, she changed it. So long after I had left, she kind of integrated Black Studies, which I felt as a loss because I knew what that section had meant to me. And so I would go there and just camp out. And I was doing lots of reading on my own, so I read all those kind of 70s novels, you know, I Never Promised You a Rose Garden, remember mm-hmm. that, and then lots of biographies. But I also really focused on the Black Studies section. And so I was reading, I don't know, Soul on Ice, Scottsboro Boys, and that kind of thing, and starting to learn about racism in America, and specifically in the South. The South was, I didn't even know where it was. I don't know, I'd never been really at that point out of New York. You know, you go upstate for picnics and that kind of thing. That was it. But learning about racism, and I think for me, time, it was hard for me at that time to sort of have a good sense of how much time had passed. So if I'm reading Scottsboro Boys or if I'm reading Soul on Ice, for me, it felt as though it was happening then. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think that for a long time, I went through life kind of expecting those kinds of things to happen, you know, just feeling insecure in America, not to the point where it ever shut me down or made me unable to function, but just kind of looking over my shoulder and wondering what people were thinking or what they might do. So that was the beginning of my interest.
Well, we'll find out more and where all of that interest took you as I continue my conversation with Heather Williams, an associate professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Just ahead, we're going to learn about her time as a civil rights lawyer and her role in the controversial Tuana Brawley case. We'll do that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, today talking with Heather Williams, an associate professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She's written a book called Self-Taught, African-American Education in Slavery and Freedom. She teaches about African-Americans during the 18th and 19th century, particularly the way enslaved people pursued education on their own. We will talk more about that, but first I want to hear a bit about your education. You went to that high school in New York, St. Anne's, and from there you went on to Harvard. What was that experience like for you? That was maybe the 1970s?
70s, right. I left St. Anne's in 74 and went to Harvard College. Actually, I was in the last class admitted to Radcliffe College, which was the women's college. And, you know, that was a really mixed bag. I was admitted to college during the time of the, I think it was Bakke at that time, the affirmative action lawsuit. And so in an environment in which even coming out of high school, I was beginning to hear again that I was supposed to be inferior to white people and that perhaps I had only been admitted to college because I was black. And actually the friend, the brother of a very close friend of mine, white people, said something to that effect once I got in. Oh, of course you got into all your colleges because you're black. Not because you were at school working really hard into the wee hours of the morning while I was out getting high and playing the guitar, but because you're black. And so I went to college, and I think all of us kind of had that hanging over us. And Harvard is an interesting place, and I've had, you know, white people say similar things to me, that it tends to be kind of impersonal. And the way I would capsulize it is that they said, oh, you're smart, you're here, good. There's no pampering, there's no nurturing, and which I'd probably appreciate more now at this stage, but then I felt it. But I had really, really good friends in college, people who are still my friends. We built a community, really a black community, within Harvard, and just worked hard, you know.
Yeah. Got through, became a lawyer.
Got through, went to Harvard Law School, and basically making that decision, you know, I was coming of age in this time, sort of after the height of the civil rights movement, and certainly people had used law as a way of making change in America. And so I think that's partly why I went, partly because I didn't know what else to do. I wasn't going to med school. I wasn't going to business school. So I went to law school. And my first job out was at the Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division, but in the criminal section of the Civil Rights Division, where we prosecuted racial violence, police brutality, that kind of thing. So I did cases involving the KKK in North Carolina. Actually, my first time in North Carolina was doing a grand jury investigation of Klan violence, and traveled all over the country because our cases were wherever they were. We just went into different districts and basically became assistant U.S. attorneys in that district. And did that work. So again, sort of coming back to face the issues that I had seen raised in the books that I'd read and the courses I had taken by now in college.
Well, that should have seemed or might have seemed like gratifying, fulfilling, and fruitful work. You're prosecuting this kind of systemic violence.
Yeah. I mean, it should.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always say I learned a lot. But I was never quite satisfied with it. I think that as a prosecutor, you're expected to see things, and black and white is what we say, and I don't mean it racially, but it's very clear that here's the law, this person broke the law, this person needs to be prosecuted and punished. And I don't always see life that way, even when I know these are bad guys. I sometimes just felt that there needed to be some more subtle approaches. So that was one thing. But also, I think that just in terms of my personality, I became a litigator. I'm in court. I mean, I was a kid. I came out of law school. I was 25 years old. And I'm this little black girl. And I would go and almost all my opposing counsel, except one, all of them were white men. Older than me. They sometimes wouldn't, I'd give them my business card. They would send the material to DC instead of sending it to me directly, even though I was in town, that kind of thing. And I think that as an attorney, you have to be contentious. As a litigator, certainly you have to be contentious. That's what you do. And I could tell you stories about what lawyers told me about just colleagues who seemed so confident, the kinds of problems that they have with that stress of being a litigator. People drank heavily, my colleagues did. And I just thought, this is not really the way that I am. I'm not a contentious person. I try not to fight with people in my personal life, but here it is. I have to kind of put on this aspect and go out and fight. And I'm competitive, so I want to win. So I do it and I win. And then it just felt unsatisfying personally. So I kind of kept changing jobs, trying to find the right place for me, the place where I could sort of be myself as much as possible, whatever that self was.
But along the way, you found yourself in the DA's office in New York at the time the Tuana Brawley case came up.
Yeah. So actually in the Attorney General's office, State Attorney General's office. I was working in some little back office that was awful. I was supervising about 12 lawyers who prosecuted people who allegedly cheated on unemployment insurance. And it was really awful. And so they called me from the main office and said, we've got this case that we're going to investigate. And we're wondering, based on your experience, if you would be willing to join the team. And so I said, yes, absolutely. And what I didn't know was that it would mean I would live in Poughkeepsie, New York for 9 months, living in a hotel, going home to Brooklyn on weekends. And yeah, we investigated for 9 months the allegations that were made on behalf of Tuana Brawley, that she was a 15-year-old black girl who had allegedly been raped over a period of 3 days in the woods by three white men. And it became a real media circus. It was sort of the pre-OJ, I think, media circus. And the grand jury ended up issuing a report that said essentially Tuana had made the story up. When she was found outside an apartment that her family had just moved out of, she had her hair had been cut crudely. She had feces on her body and in her hair, and writing on her chest with some kind of charcoal that said KKK. And Al Sharpton and two attorneys from Brooklyn, Maddox and Mason, got involved at her family's behest and basically charged that these three men, and they named the men. One was a a guy who had been trying to become a state trooper, I think, and had failed the test for the third time, final time, and his girlfriend had broken up with him, and he committed suicide shortly after this weekend. It was Thanksgiving weekend, 18.
You're back in your research.
Yeah. 1987. And so he killed himself, and then they found out that he had been in a car with two other people going to the mall. And so they alleged that the guy who had killed himself and then a deputy district attorney in Orange County and another man had indeed kidnapped Tawana and taken her to the woods and raped her repeatedly over this period of time. Well, we did the FBI. We worked closely with the FBI and with state troopers. And we had a man from the FBI, an agent who works in a lab that tests animal feces. And I mean, the things you learn, right? Yeah. So he can tell you dog, horse, whatever. And he determined that the feces on her body had come from the dog next door to where she lived. And they found a burnt piece of cloth in the apartment that they think had been used to mark her body. And there was just lots of evidence that said that she had done this herself. Now, the thing is, the hospital had botched the rape kit. And so there was no evidence that she had been, no sort of physical evidence that she had been raped or not raped. But she had no scratches on her, no marks, no leaves in her hair, nothing like that. And so it was a really tough case. I think it was really hard on African Americans in the area who in New York really who heard about this because some awful incidents of racial violence had occurred in the year before that. Sharpton, Maddox, and Mason had been involved, which is how her parents knew to contact them. You know, where people went into a neighborhood and were beaten with baseball bats and that kind of thing, and they know the history of this country around racial violence and rape, especially sexual abuse of Black women. And so they knew that this could have happened, and many people believed that it had happened. And as it became disclosed that maybe it hadn't happened, I think people were really hurt by it because it is that situation where in a sense, it makes other women more vulnerable because who's going to believe them next time? And so it was a tough case. And all kinds of people were calling me, asking me, you know, all of a sudden you're very popular when you're working on a case like that. And of course, I had been trained at Justice. You don't talk to the media. You don't talk to anybody. You know, there's none of that. And so lawyers were calling me. I mean, all kinds of people wanted me as the Black person on the team to confirm for them their belief that this had happened. And mostly I just couldn't say anything.
What were you feeling at the time, though? If you felt like you could talk, what would you say?
At first, I thought I was investigating a real case. I mean, I really did. And I think that there may have been other people on the team who much sooner than I realized that something was off. But I was looking for who had done this. I was looking for evidence, working really closely with a couple of the investigators from the state police. And as it went on, I guess gradually I'm sitting in the grand jury, I'm helping put on witnesses and I'm hearing the testimony and it just looked really. But, you know, I don't think that I think that because I was involved professionally, I was less personally involved. So I kind of felt the pain of the people who were contacting me and the people who were writing in the newspapers and who were the Amsterdam News. I mean, there was a woman from the Amsterdam News who just, I felt like she just sat in her bed at night and just wrote these stories because they were pretty much fiction and she didn't know what was going on, but she was putting this story out there. And Amsterdam News is a Black paper in New York. So I was conscious of the struggle that people were having and the need that they did not want this Black girl. You know, a lot of Black people, I don't know, maybe less now than before, but feel really, there's a way in which you're connected to other Black people, even if you don't know them, because you know that in the society, what one person does very often is attributed to other people. And so if it's a negative thing, if it's a positive thing, oh, that's a great person, individual.
That's the individual.
Right, that's the individual. Yeah. But I think people kind of used to hold their breath, and I don't know if it happens as much now, but used to hold their breath when they heard something and sort of wondering, oh, you know, how are we all going to end up paying for this? And so I felt that. I definitely felt that coming from other people. But, you know, if you're involved in it day by day, you're more, I was more just trying to figure it out, you know.
Sure, I'm professionally. But later, as you step back from the story and you think back and put it in context for yourself, what did you take something else away from that? I mean, how did you feel about that?
You know, I think I took more bafflement from it. One of the things that we learned in the grand jury from two psychiatrists was that there, and we've seen cases like this now in the media from white women, women who tell stories like this, for whatever reason, we think that Tawana did it. The best explanation is that she had gone to visit her boyfriend in the county jail, and her parents had forbidden that, and she had overstayed her time out, and so she, you know, she's a 15-year-old kid, and so she kind of helps, she puts herself in this situation, and then other people spoke for her and came up with this story. She never named anybody. So, but one of the things they talked about was that there are some women who will make up stories like this, sometimes to get attention, sometimes to avoid the consequences of other behavior. So you push your kids, you know, in a car into the river and you say, oh, the Black man did it. Right. And so I learned a lot in that sense. But I mean, I was learning more kind of details and an understanding of how the law works and the expectations of the public, so the media, but also the Black people who were involved, the pain that this was causing to the men who had been accused. You know, it's a complex kind of situation, and just always trying to figure out, well, why did this happen?
What was going through your mind then as the Duke LaCrosse story crossed the headlines?
Well, you know, what I knew about the Duke case was that I knew enough to know I didn't know. And that I knew from Tawana Brawley, that I just, Tawana, I was involved in every aspect of the case. I was seeing all the pieces of evidence, and I still didn't really know. And certainly, just because somebody makes an allegation doesn't mean that I then immediately conclude that that's true. Now, I'll tell you, I think that those young men behaved very badly. And I think that some of that got lost in, I understand, you know, their parents have to defend their kids. But I think that as a community, some of that got lost, not looking closely at that behavior and some of the things that they expressed. And I think that's really dangerous. And so, but yeah, I knew not to jump to conclusions because I just didn't know.
When did you decide then to leave law and go into the academy and study history?
Well, it took a while. I kept changing jobs, trying to find something that I thought would be more to my liking. And I just never found the right job. And then I went back and taught at my old school at St. Anne's, which goes from preschool to high school. And I taught fourth grade English, middle school quilt making, courses on race and racism. And I loved it. I fell in love with teaching. I realized how hard it was. I mean, there's a really steep learning curve, and I didn't know what I was doing. But I really loved it. And I guess it was 95. I took a National Endowment for the Humanities summer seminar for school teachers at a college in Virginia, and decided this is what I want to do. I want to read. I want to think. I want to write. I want to come to seminar and discuss. I'm going to grad school. So I went back that fall and applied to grad school, and went to Yale and did a PhD in American Studies.
What led you to your interest in education during slavery?
I was taking a course with a professor at Yale who's now deceased, John Blassingame, African-American professor. who was one of the first people to really study slavery and to think about the African Americans who had been enslaved, not just the institution and not just the owners. And he assigned a book that talked about missionaries going south after the war and sort of bringing education. And the author, who I think is pretty radical, said, you know, black people needed the vote. They needed jobs. They needed all kinds of help. Education was the least of it. But this is what these missionaries brought. And something about that said to me, huh, I wonder if that's what they thought. I wonder if the people coming out of slavery thought education was the least of it. And it really was a question, but it was a question that just latched on to me. And I think maybe coming from my background then of teaching, my mother was a teacher, I don't know, it just all came together. And I wrote several papers just examining different aspects of it. What were former slaves saying in their interviews during the Depression? What did education look like for elite whites in the South or for whites in the South? And then I found out, oh, it's about elite whites having an education in the South during the antebellum period. And it became my dissertation. And I just dug and dug and dug, because trying to find sources about African Americans in the 19th century is tough. 18th century is even harder, but 19th century, it's really tough. And you just have to look at the fragments that you find and put things together.
We will learn more about what you found and how it all adds up as my conversation with Heather Williams continues, Associate Professor of History at UNC Chapel Hill. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Heather Williams, an associate professor of history at UNC Chapel Hill, especially African Americans during the 18th and 19th century. Her book is Self-Taught, African American Education in Slavery and Freedom. And that title, Self-Taught, is important because we get the impression when we hear about, particularly the post-war period, of these sort of people coming in, giving to former enslaved people what they need, including education. But you found out that there was a great hunger, and in fact, African-American enslaved people were providing their own education for quite a while.
Right. I started with that question, what did they want? And started my research in the post-war period and then realized I needed to go back to the people who were now free, that they hadn't just arrived one day full-blown as free people, that there was a backstory. And so I went back and looked at slavery. And so the book begins with slavery. And what I found was that, I don't know numbers, I can't tell you what percentage of people became literate, but I found that a lot of people valued literacy, wanted to learn how to read and write, and they wanted it for lots of reasons, well, several reasons. They wanted to be able, they said, to read the Bible for themselves, because ministers would come and that the owner provided, and they said, you know, many, many people said this. Every time he came, we would hear the same story. Servants, obey your masters. And we just thought there must be more in that big book than that. So we wanted to be able to read it for ourselves. And of course, I won't go into that. But, you know, thinking about how people interpreted the Bible for themselves, mm-hmm. and how they used that as part of a liberation struggle. They wanted to be able to do very concrete things like write a pass that might get them to freedom. So the slave owners in the South relied on a piece of paper. Sometimes badges. In Charleston, they had badges, metal badges that they made for people. But as a black person, it was assumed that you were a slave, that you belonged to somebody, and that person, you had to be accountable to that person at all times. And so if you wanted to move about in a town or through a rural area, you had to have written permission from your owner. And enslaved people obviously knew that. And so people wanted to learn. Several people I saw said, I wanted to learn how, when my mother was sold away, I decided that at some point I was going to escape. And I needed to learn how to write so that I could write a pass. And so very practical kinds of reasons. But they also were, you know, surrounded by whites who had power and who were literate. They walked these white children to school. Some owners had school on the plantation for their children, had private tutors from the North. children went away. As young people came back educated, they took over. They were in charge. And so they had this great desire to become literate. And I think had a sense that once they became free, they would need to be literate because free people had literacy. And certainly free people who were in power had literacy, meaning free white people. So that's where I began. And I document the methods by which they learned. Sometimes a slave owner's wife would begin to teach an enslaved person, some favored slave who was around the house, how to read, because she thought that everybody should be able to read the Bible, right? So evangelical Christianity plays a part in that. And however somebody learned, what I found was that people would then go off and teach other people. Mm-hmm. So they held school in the back of the plantation, out of the sight of owners. A woman talked about a pit that people had dug in the back of the plantation, and in this pit, kind of a trench is what I imagine, they hid runaway slaves, but they also held school in there on Sundays when owners were off visiting or at church. And so people were using different methods. They had Webster's Blueback Speller, and I went to the library at Yale, and they had some of the original Webster's Blueback Spellers. It's a little spelling book in which you go from A and sound out. They would take boys, especially boys and men who had some more mobility than women because they're running the errands, they're going to the post office to pick up the mail, that kind of thing, would take the book with them under their hats and stop some white person who they thought they could trust and say, the boys would say, I bet you can't tell me what this says, right? And so there's this way in which they pieced it together. Yeah. And after writing the book, I still don't know how you teach yourself to read because...
Well, there were some fascinating strategies here, and I'd like to talk about them, that involved eavesdropping. The idea of just overhearing people read, then transmitting that and somehow learning to read. But for instance, John Quincy Adams, tell us about him.
Mm-hmm. So people used eavesdropping as a strategy. So one of the things I wanted to say in the book was that not all black people during slavery learned how to read and write. And we cannot say that because you were not literate, I think that we certainly culturally have a bias in favor of literacy. And we think that if you're not literate, you're not intelligent. And I think that's really dangerous in our time, but certainly when you're looking back at this time period. And so one of the things that was really important to me was to say, a lot of people were trying to become literate and did become literate, but most people didn't. But that doesn't mean that they did not also have a desire to be free. They didn't think, etc. And so I talk about eavesdropping because I saw that in a number of places where, for instance, somebody who is serving a child, serving the white people on the porch, and it's close to the Civil War, the white people don't want the slaves to know what they're talking about. And so when they got to sensitive issues, they would spell out the words. And this person didn't know how to read, didn't know how to spell, didn't know how to decode that, but knew how to memorize and knew that this meant important things were being said when the spelling took place. And so would memorize the words and then go back to a relative who could decode it and repeat what she had heard. And so they just use lots of different strategies.
I mean, it's all the more remarkable if you don't know the names of the letters. You're just really memorizing sounds.
Right,
because you're not identifying them with letters.
You don't know what an L is, but you hear L-O-V-E and you can repeat that. So they used lots of different strategies. And once they... became literate, as I said, they're teaching other people, and there's a story I tell about Mattie Jackson and her mother, and basically her mother had learned how to read. She doesn't tell us how, and then the mother taught the daughter. And during the war, soldiers, this was in Missouri, would come and throw newspapers over the fence, and probably as a strategy of intimidating the owners, but they would pick up the newspapers, the enslaved mother and child. And she talks about how her mother cut out a picture of Abraham Lincoln and put it on the wall in her room. And then the owner goes in and sees this and is livid because they're cursing Lincoln. And, you know, and so they're using lots of different strategies. You know, they're using literacy then as a weapon almost, you know. How do you know this is Abraham Lincoln? Well, because I can read that it says it's Abraham Lincoln. And I want you to know this means something to me, because she knows that where she lives is the owner's property and he has access to it at any time. And so, yeah, so they use lots of strategies. And what I found was then following them out of slavery, already I now have a sense of a strong desire for literacy and a sense of why they wanted to be literate. And then when I follow them out of slavery into contraband camps, into freedom, really, then you see them, the sources kind of open up as the war begins, as more people from the North are coming south. You get more records that reflect what Black people were doing and thinking. And you see them trying to use, to become literate, to have more schools set up. They've already been teaching. They continue to teach throughout the war. Men who finally get admitted as soldiers into the Union set up schools within the camps. The Black chaplains, there are 12 Black chaplains, and they're writing to their higher up saying, you're not paying the Black soldiers what you pay the white soldiers. You're not promoting them. You're not giving them any medals. At least send us some books, because they want to learn how to read and write. Because these men thought that they would then be the leaders in their communities. White men were leaders. Black men are going to be leaders in their communities. And they know that literacy is a really important part of carrying that out.
Well, and you said something that's very interesting, and I don't want to skip over it too quickly. Uh-huh. The idea that is particularly perhaps during the Civil War, enslaved people were imagining what would happen afterwards. When we become free, if we become free, what does that mean and what are we going to need? People were imagining this, talking about it, and making provision for it.
That's right. Absolutely. I think that throughout slavery, you had people escaping. So you have people who are trying to become free during slavery. But I think people had created, this is what you see after or during the war, really, is that they're making plans about what they should do and what freedom's going to look like and how to make freedom meaningful that could not have just arisen overnight. These are things that they had been thinking about for a long time, maybe for generations, you know, but during the war, they realized that more than anything, slavery was a place. So slavery is a concept. But it was also for them a place. They had to get somewhere to get freedom. You don't just sit there on the plantation. You move out. And so they start, you know, I talked about contrabands. They go to Union officers.
You should explain what that is. Contraband camps, because initially we didn't know what to do with escaped slaves.
Right,
and they
exactly.
were considered contraband of war.
Right. So during, the war began April 1861. May of 1861, three Black men went to General Butler at Fortress Monroe in Virginia, Hampton, Virginia, and said, you need to do something because we're slaves and our owners are about to send us south to help build fortifications for the Confederacy. And you need to do something. And Butler said, you know, Virginia has seceded from the Union. Therefore, Virginia's our enemy. I'm going to seize these people as contrabands of war, just as I would seize a ship of the Confederacy or a horse. And so they're going to become contrabands of war. And so it began with three men in Virginia. Within 4 months, there were 900 Black people at Fortress Monroe under that sort of banner of contrabands of war. Now, this was a major problem for the Union Army, and Union officers are saying, I'm not in this. This is not a... They're mimicking what Lincoln's saying, right? This is not a war about slavery. This is not a war about slavery. This is a white man's war. I'm not a slave catcher. I'm not here. I don't have anything to do with Negroes. What am I supposed to do with these people? They keep showing up. And some of them send people back. So Mattie Jackson and her friend ran away in Missouri and got sent back to their owner when the owner came to claim them. Other places like Fortress Monroe, people just came. You see Harper's Weekly has a sketch of a bridge that goes into, just a little bridge that goes into Fortress Monroe, packed with people, streaming into the fort. The Freedom Fort is what they called it. And so wherever Union soldiers went, people were going to them. And so they become named contrabands of war. Most of them were put to work. So now, instead of working on Confederate fortifications, which of course lots of enslaved people did, they're working on Union fortifications. They're building roads. They're doing carrying stuff. Women are working in the camps for white officers, that kind of thing. So they become part of the war in that sense, before they could even enlist in the Union Army. And so they had to get to a place to become free. And they're, even in those camps, in those contraband camps, they're complaining that they've been working for the Union and the Union's not paying them. They said they would pay them, but they're not paying them. They're thinking about freedom. Should we leave and go to Haiti? So this old idea of colonization comes back that had begun way in the early 1800s, that black people and white people are not going to be able to get along in the same place. And so we, you know, the colonization society said, we'll send them to Sierra Leone, we'll send them to Haiti, get them out of here. Thomas Jefferson says they'll never get along because of the prejudices of whites and the anger of blacks. Black people are going to hate us, because if you did what I'm doing to you, I'd hate you. And that's never going to go away. And so they're having those kinds of conversations. And they're also asking for teachers to come. So a white missionary comes in to Hampton, Virginia. And, you know, this is early in the war. The Union has taken over. And a white missionary comes because the white churches in the North want to build their churches, and they want to send missionaries. And the black people essentially say, look, we've got black ministers. We've got ministers. We don't need ministers. We need teachers. We've got somebody over here who's been teaching other people, but he's used up all that he knows. In Hampton, you had a woman who was teaching, even during slavery, had a school. It was illegal, but she was doing it. And they say, they've been doing this, but they have used up what they know. The children are learning so quickly. We need some trained teachers. And so what I found was that it wasn't that the missionaries had this idea. It was that the black people went to the missionaries and said, send us some teachers. And many teachers did come.
Thank you so much for talking with us. I wish I had more time.
Oh.
Fantastic talking with you. Heather Williams, Associate Professor of History at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thanks so much. Her book, Self-Taught, African-American Education in Slavery and Freedom. To learn more about the research and the book, you can go to, do you have a website?
No, just the UNC website.
UNC,
look UNC up. History Department.
Self-Taught's the name of the book. Heather Williams is the professor. Our series, North Carolina Voices, Civil War, continues throughout the week. Stay with us on the state of things. Thanks for listening. If you have a comment on the show or want to hear an archived edition, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. Check us out on Facebook as well. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.